Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast from the BBC World Service, bringing you extraordinary personal stories from around the globe. Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing, and on this edition, a Franco-Chinese summit in Paris. President Xi says China's overcapacity of production is a myth. But can French and European manufacturing find a way of working with Beijing? Also, Qantas has to pay more than $66 million over the sale of tickets for flights that never flew. And...
So water is the biggest danger down here, yeah?
Yes.
And this is very difficult. More dangerous, of course.
We go underground in Europe's largest zinc, lead and silver mine. Plus, we meet the rising number of billionaires in Sweden. That's all coming up. But now, it's the first time the president of China has set foot in Europe in 5 years, and Xi Jinping has chosen Paris as his first venue there. Officially, it's a celebration of the 60th anniversary of the re-establishing of diplomatic relations between France and China. But there's a lot more on the table between both leaders. The opening remarks were friendly and general. Here's President Xi.
The world today has entered a new period of turbulence and change. As two important forces in the world, China and the EU should remain partners, adhere to dialogue and cooperation, deepen strategic communication, enhance strategic mutual trust, build strategic consensus, and carry out strategic coordination.
He did, however, go on to deny that there was a problem of Chinese overcapacity in production. That's something France and the EU have definitely been worrying about. For his part, President Macron laid out both the trade agenda and various international crises to be discussed.
The future of our continent will very clearly depend on our ability to continue to develop relations with China in a balanced manner. I suggest that we first address Euro-Chinese relations, which will allow us to discuss commercial issues like market access, fair competition, investment, and harmonious development. And secondly, we will discuss Ukraine and the Middle East, two major crises on which coordination between us is absolutely decisive.
Well, the European Commission's also involved in these talks, and along with expressing concerns about Beijing's support for Russia in Ukraine, trade is very much to the fore. The European Commission head, Ursula von der Leyen, said she raised the issue of Chinese subsidised goods distorting EU markets.
These subsidised products, such as the electric vehicles or, for example, steel, are flooding the European market. At the same time, China continues to massively support its manufacturing sector, and this combined with a domestic demand that is not increasing, the world cannot absorb China's surplus production.
Ursula von der Leyen. Well, our Paris correspondent Hugh Schofield has been looking into what both sides want from this meeting.
I think the Chinese calculate that France is a country that might be susceptible to a bit of diplomatic glad-handing, a bit of flattery. Essentially, what Xi wants is to prevent there being too united a front among the Western powers in their attitude towards China. Now, relations between Beijing and the US are obviously very poor at the moment and may get worse if there's a Trump second term. And today there are signs that the Europeans are moving towards that American view. In other words, a view that China is a destabilizing factor in world trade. Look at these EU anti-dumping investigations into Chinese exports of electric cars and so on. The Chinese, I think, want to nip that potential US-Europe rapprochement in the bud. He's hoping to convince Macron, and through him the Europeans, that it's worth their while to pursue a third way with China.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. So what's the perspective from Beijing? Here's our China media analyst, Kerry Allen.
There's been a heavy emphasis in Chinese media this week that the friendship between China and France has spanned decades and outlasted any relationship China has with other Western countries. China has been actively promoting French landmarks, museums and cuisine this week, ahead of Xi Jinping's visit. Last time the Chinese president was in France in 2019, state media reported that the two leaders had agreed to forge a more solid, stable and vigorous relationship. And this week, they're stressing that there's been positive momentum since the global pandemic and that China and France have cooperated in technology, trade and cultural exchanges. Chinese broadcaster CGTN says that the trade volume between the two countries has reached $78.9 billion and that import and export to France has grown at an average annual rate of 5.9% over the last 5 years.
And that was China media analyst Kerry Allen. So a lot to talk about in Paris. But is there any chance of reaching a rapprochement? Well, earlier I spoke to Pascal Lamy, the former European Trade Commissioner, also former head of the World Trade Organization. France's finance minister, Bruno Le Maire, has said France and China are far from a balance in trade. So I asked Monsieur Lamy if a balanced partnership was really possible.
Yes, indeed. On the trade side, a more balanced relationship does not mean a balanced trade account. I don't know whether there is any country on this planet, except for rich oil producers or minerals, that have a trade balance with China. The reality is that we have a way too unbalanced relationship, mainly, if not only, with the way China runs its economy, with a very low level of consumption relative to their GDP, a very high level of investment in industrial capacities, hence their tendency to dump quite a lot of what they do not consume locally and overproduce into international markets. This is what we know. Le Maire, if that's what he means, I think he's right.
But, Monsieur Lamy, the problem, surely, then, is how to address that, because short of tariffs, which would, of course, invite compensatory tariffs from the Chinese, there's no sign that China is willing to pull back on any of this.
Well, there is a way to do that, which is open more China and increase China's domestic consumption, where it is obviously subdued in the services area. I'm going to China quite often, as everybody, the COVID interruption. But what's striking with the Chinese economy is how developed they are in manufacturers, including in high tech like green tech, and how underdeveloped their domestic services market is. China should open more its services market. And the other side, they should stop heavily subsidizing their exports, which they do, which, by the way, is not in conformity with WTO rules, which is why, in some cases, the EU has to use either anti-dumping or anti-subsidy compensatory measures.
But those sort of measures, Monsieur Lamy, are going to not be popular, obviously, in Beijing. And do you detect on your trips to China any willingness by the Chinese authorities to address those problems you're talking about?
Although I would not say I'm sure, but I think the Chinese leadership recognizes that the macroeconomic model they have for the moment, with not enough consumption, too much investment, i.e. too much capacity, is not sustainable. The reason why they have so little consumption is that they have a very high level of savings. The Chinese don't have a proper social security system. This is a macroeconomic problem and not a trade problem, or more precisely, the trade problem stems from a source, which is the Chinese macroeconomic system. And by the way, you have exactly the symmetry with the US, who overconsume and do not save enough. Origin of these huge trade imbalances are of a macroeconomic nature. I'm not saying all trade imbalances are like that. There are competitiveness issues. There's an issue of the size of the country, of its economy. But in this case, when they are so huge, in the case of China, as well on the other side, and reverse in number in the case of the US, it is a macroeconomic issue. And I think, personally, that it is the interest of the Chinese leadership to rebalance a system which is not sustainable.
Well, you may think it's in their interest, Monsieur Lamy, but there's no sign at the moment that China is moving in that direction. And to be specific, for example, the whole problem about electric vehicles being produced very cheaply in China, being exported potentially to Europe, and destroying the European potential for manufacturing EVs is a current active issue. How on earth should Europe, should France deal with that?
Well, if it is the case that China heavily subsidizes its EV car production, then EU is entitled, as per the rules of WTO, to compensate the subsidy element with tariff. The China may not like it, but this is something which is allowed, as it is, by the way, in the case of anti-dumping, by the rules of WTO.
But isn't it likely that China would simply respond to such tariffs, perhaps through WTO, but potentially also just through compensatory tariffs, for example, on cognac, which is a major issue, of course, for China? We saw what happened with Australia, with the massive markup on Australian wine and how crippled the Australian wine industry was by that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. But the Chinese understood, in the case of Australia, after some time, that it was a stupid thing to do, and they stopped doing it.
You think the same will happen this time if they try and penalise cognac?
Depends on which ground China penalises cognac. As far as I know, I'm not aware that the French cognac producers benefit from heavy subsidy from the EU or from France.
Pascal Lamy there, and apologies for, I'm afraid, a slightly difficult line. I hope you're able to understand what he had to say. But let me bring in Natasha Abdahaj there, fund manager, global equities at Artemis Investment Management, joining us. Natasha, thanks for being with us. What is the reaction or the feeling about Europe from European investors about this threat of Chinese overcapacity dominating, for example, in EVs?
Well, I think from the European point of view, they'll be watching essentially the appetite for Chinese firms to set up manufacturing overseas in particular. I mean, the politics are working on stopping maybe the imports, but maybe longer term, an alternative issue may also be Chinese firms starting to put up plants in countries such as France and Hungary. And we've already seen that with the investment of CATL, China's largest battery manufacturer, putting up a plant in Hungary in partnership with Mercedes-Benz to supply battery technology into Europe. So that's a longer term threat that investors are also watching for.
All right. Thanks very much, Natasha. Natasha Abdahaj there, Artemis Investment Management.
Chasing Mountains is the story of five incredible mountaineers competing to become the first woman to climb all 14 of the world's highest mountain peaks, the so-called 8,000ers.
Pitting themselves against nature on the roof of the world.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, Kosovo is, per capita, Central Europe's poorest economy. Ever since a brutal war in the 1990s, the territory has been effectively self-governed, but it still isn't recognised as independent by a number of other nations, including Serbia, which claims it as its own. Kosovo does have some economic advantages, though. For example, it's home to Europe's largest zinc, lead and silver mine. It's called Trepča, and our own Ed Butler recently donned his hard hat to go and visit.
Ooh. It's not the smoothest lift I've ever caught. Having rattled down 700 metres or so in a rickety box, my ears popping, I reach the flooded tunnels where the digging happens. I'm in the company of local mine worker Ilmi Shibani.
So water is the biggest danger down here, yeah?
Yes. And this is very difficult. More dangerous, of course.
The Trepča mine, just outside of the city of Mitrovica in northern Kosovo, has for almost a century been one of the region's biggest employers. 700 men work across several sites, but that's just a fraction of the 20,000 who used to work in the mine in its heyday. Despite lead and zinc being valued commodities, the site is desperately lacking investment.
So he's lifting a really heavy pneumatic drill, the kind of thing you'd see a guy using maybe in a street drilling a hole, and he's pushing it up against the roof of this big cave we're in now, into the roof. It's hot down here. I'm sweating just looking at these guys.
They drill these holes to put the dynamite. This is the classic way, but what can we do?
So this is the way they've been doing it for decades and decades?
Yep.
Because you don't have better machinery?
Yes.
And if you had better machinery, you'd have a big...
It will be safer, it will be faster, and it will be more productive.
We eventually come up to breathe cooler air, and as we emerge, we meet an elderly miner. His wheezing voice and blackened face show every one of his 30-plus years spent underground.
Haradin Sadiku.
How old are you?
63 years old. From when I started here, the air is more polluted. Dust affects negatively.
Do you know people who've suffered from lung problems because of their work as a miner?
Most of them, they didn't wait to get retired. They die earlier.
Wow.
This one is the good example to see the galenite from which we extract the lead, for example.
Incredibly heavy stone.
Back in the manager's office, Ilmi is showing me samples of the rocks that they've extracted here. But without plants to refine the ore into a more valuable finished product, the money-making potential for the gold and silver that's also underground is limited.
We sell it to the foreign companies, but unfortunately we sell it as a semi-product.
It's not refined here in Kosovo. Yeah.
This is our bad luck, that we are having it under us and we are selling it just for lead and zinc.
Are you making a profit here? Are you actually making money for the government that invests in you?
Unfortunately, we are not making profits for our government.
You are not making profits at the moment?
No.
I think that Trepča needs huge investment. Global contractors, they know very well how to exploit 1 million ton. And I think for the next 5 years will be approximately 10,000 people employed.
That rosy assessment of what Trepča could be producing comes from local geologist Gani Malici. He says that the extra jobs properly shared could help to heal Kosovo's enduring ethnic divisions. But it's never quite that simple here in the Balkans, for one thing. Serbia and Kosovo continue to argue over which government actually owns all of this buried treasure. And when I asked Kosovo's Prime Minister how he intended to improve the mine, Albin Kurti was unwilling to entertain the idea of some major private sector investment. He wants citizens to invest instead.
Trepča is rich, but it needs a settlement for smooth functioning. And now we plan to include Trepča into the sovereign wealth fund, which we are building, where instead of having any kind of brutal, abusive, neoliberal privatization, we want to enable people to buy shares, so we democratize the economy.
But you're going to need a foreign partner, ultimately, to jump in to invest, aren't you? Because, as you say, you need massive investment to make that mine really work.
Of course, we need investment from abroad. Our diaspora can be such an investor. But also, we look forward to cooperate with private corporations from both sides of the Atlantic.
Kosovo's Prime Minister Albin Kurti. The reality is, though, that Kosovo remains Western Europe's poorest economy. Without better job opportunities, many local people say that young people aren't going to be looking to invest at the moment. Most are simply trying to leave.
Ed Butler in Kosovo. Now, what are ghost flights? Well, in the past, that's been the term for a flight operated by an airline on a regularly scheduled route with an aircraft containing less than 10% of the plane's total capacity, in order to keep open a slot at an airport, for example. But the Australian airline Qantas has just been fined $66 million for doing another form of ghost flying, advertising and selling tickets on tens of thousands of flights that have been cancelled. Well, Qantas is also going to pay out additional compensation to close to 90,000 travellers affected by the cancellations. Well, the head of the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission said the airline's conduct had been egregious and unacceptable. Qantas had argued that rather than selling customers seats on specific flights, it offered the promise that it would do its best to get passengers to where they wanted to be on time. So are other airlines doing the same thing? Alex Macheras is an aviation analyst, consultant, advisor. He joins me on the line now. Alex, thanks for being with us here on World Business Report. How widespread is this practice that Qantas were doing here?
Good afternoon. Well, it's not so widespread in aviation because what quickly happens is that the authorities that are involved with regulating aviation in that respective country often either catch on or are notified, and then the airline faces a very costly bill that it otherwise wouldn't have had to face had it have not engaged in something that is ultimately misleading. So in this specific scenario, Roger, what it really means is that you were able in mid-2022, that was the summer that aviation really was trying to bounce back after all of the lockdown years and the restrictions and COVID and so on. And that summer was really chaotic for air travel because it was like trying to start up an old car after it had been kind of sitting dormant for 2 years. It was really rusty. There were massive issues to iron out. And what Qantas were doing is they got quite excited at the prospect of being able to sell more tickets, the great return to the skies for passengers, that they promised a schedule that they then quickly realized they would no way be able to deliver in terms of actually, you know, enabling and having the aircraft fly and staffing these flights with pilots and crew and so on. But while they realized that, they didn't take fast enough action to stop the likes of you and I from going on board, from going online and buying tickets for those flights that the airline knew were never going to operate.
But then, what they did was they kind of said, well, we'll get you there some way afterwards. I mean, is this kind of thing? I mean, you said that the regulators get onto it, but have other airlines tried it?
Other airlines do engage with this and continue to engage in it, specifically in summer, but it's on a far more limited scale. This is one of the case studies that I think will go down in the aviation books as a pretty significant and sizable scale because they knew these flights weren't going to operate. And now here we're talking 2 years later where Qantas have had to settle with the regulators in Australia. They're going to be paying every passenger with a booking who was affected around $300 to $450 Australian dollars per person, incredibly costly for them. This is also one of the reasons why the now former CEO, Alan Joyce of Qantas, had to resign.
Yeah, because it's a huge reputational issue as well, isn't it?
It's massive. And this is, we're talking about a national carrier. We are not talking about, you know, an agile, small, low-cost carrier, you know, trying to chase every bit of profit margin. This is the flag carrier of Australia. It was their first summer after the pandemic to come back with full force, and they got greedy, and that's the fact.
But Alex, briefly, there's also the other side of things, which is overbooking flights and, you know, selling you tickets you can't actually use because you can't get on the flight. Is that still happening a lot?
Overbooking still happens, but luckily our data and our algorithms are far more sophisticated than they have ever been. And it does mean that most of the time, while airlines are engaging in overbooking, it doesn't actually relate into anyone being turned away from the flight because statistically, they know X number of people are going to miss it for whatever reason. So thankfully, that's why we don't see many horror stories about passengers that arrive and they weren't able to fly.
Grim business. A funny way to run a business, but it sort of works, I suppose, most of the time, apart obviously there from Qantas. Alex, thanks so much for being with us. Alex Macheras there with a take on what has rather damaged Qantas's reputation. Now, has Sweden become a paradise for the super rich? For decades, it's enjoyed a global reputation for championing social equality, but there's been a rapid boom in the number of Swedish multimillionaires and billionaires in recent years. And there are growing debates about how that's affecting the economy and Swedish values. Maddie Savage reports now from Stockholm.
Lidingö is a wealthy neighbourhood, home to wooden villas with turrets and new minimalist mansions. I'm getting a tour of Conrad Bergström's home.
Nice to meet you.
He's an entrepreneur who founded businesses including an electric boat brand and a designer headphone and speaker company.
And then we have a little stage, so I have a lot of musical friends, but I had very many great professional musicians here.
No celebrities you're willing to name?
There's been some here.
There's also a pool, a gym, and a basement nightclub.
20 years ago, to build a fortune, you had to do it over generations. But now, you know, you can make a fortune in like 5 to 10 years.
Sweden has experienced a big growth in self-made millionaires like Conrad. And according to Forbes, the country now has more dollar billionaires in relation to its population size than almost anywhere else in the world. Around 4 per million people, compared to 2 per million in the United States. This is partly down to Sweden's strong startup scene, with businesses like Skype and Spotify paving the way for other successful tech, gaming and investment companies. But some argue it means Sweden's no longer prioritising social equality, an important concept in politics here for more than a century.
So my name is Andreas Scherwenka. I'm a journalist and author.
He recently won Sweden's top journalism prize for a book called Greedy Sweden. It highlights that although taxes on top salaries remain high, Sweden has scrapped wealth and inheritance taxes, and there are low tax rates on money made from investing.
You don't have to move out of Sweden if you're a billionaire today. Actually, some billionaires are moving here.
And he argues the boom in the super rich has inflated property prices, encouraged people to get into debt, and reshaped Swedish values.
We have become more of a mentality of winner takes it all, that, you know, if you just play your cards right, you can also become a billionaire. So why raise the taxes?
But others argue Sweden's new super rich are creating jobs and opportunities. Here's entrepreneur Conrad Bergström again.
We have a nanny and gardener and cleaners, and that also gives more job. So we shouldn't forget about how we're building the society.
Andreas's book has got Swedes talking. He says he's even had emails from billionaires questioning Sweden's concentration of wealth. In the city centre, Sweden's African Professionals Network is meeting to hear a speech from Lola Akinmadi, a Nigerian-Swedish author and entrepreneur.
Do you see a path to becoming the CEO of IKEA? Will they let you become the CEO of IKEA, right?
She points out Sweden's wealth is still largely owned by white men, despite the country's large immigrant population and decades of championing gender equality.
So, yes, it's where people can create new money, create new wealth, but it's still very closed. And the double standards are quite high in terms of who gets their ideas funded.
Although many Swedes are proud of their country's disproportionate success in tech and business, many are also now reflecting on who it's benefiting.
And that was Maddie Savage reporting amongst the growing numbers of really quite rich in Sweden and the consequences it's having for that country. That's it from World Business Report from me and the rest of the team. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Chasing Mountains is the story of five incredible mountaineers competing to become the first woman to climb all 14 of the world's highest mountain peaks, the so-called 8,000ers.
Pitting themselves against nature on the roof of the world.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.